Right, so welcome to the new civic year, and welcome everybody, being new, to the Committee of Finance, Audit and Risk. I was new last year, and Terry Hone, who's sat in this chair, read out a statement of kind of what it is that we're supposed to do, and it was really useful, so I thought that I would start the meeting by reading that out, so that we know why we're here tonight, and then we can get on through the agenda. So the role of this committee is to provide independent scrutiny and assurance of finance, audit and internal control matters, and to provide effective scrutiny of financial matters. This also encompasses corporate governance and risk management. This committee reports to the Cabinet, and the work of the committee provides assurance to the Cabinet and the Council on the annual accounts, risk management, audit and internal control. It's a pretty important committee because actually the Cabinet will be asking us whether we are satisfied that all of those things are being run appropriately and being run well. So it's important to make sure that you read the masses of papers and get through anything that you don't understand, ask questions. I will be asking the stupidest of questions tonight because although I've sat in that chair, I've not sat in this one and I won't know what I'm doing. Feel free to do the same, and we're going to talk about, kind of, as a committee, how we're going to upskill and get ourselves to a position where we're able to deliver what we need to deliver. So, welcome. I've got apologies, agenda item one. I've got apologies from Steve Deakin Davis. I've got apologies and a substitute from Steve Jarvis and Sam Collins. You're substituting, is that right?
That's correct.
Any others? Do we know about Michael Weaver?
No, I'm afraid I don't.
You don't, okay. So, we've got the minutes of the 21st of March. That's me. I'm the only one that can agree those because I'm the only one that's here and I'm happy to, having read them, I'm content. And we've got notification of other business, of which I have none. Unless anybody has any? No. So, Chair's announcements. I have to read this verbatim, so forgive me. I would like to thank those who are no longer members of this committee, which is Councillors Terry Hone, Simon Harwood, Ian Albert, Jim McNally, Ian Moody and Terry Tyler. I would like to welcome Councillors Morgan Derbyshire, Steve Jarvis, Sam North, Kate Hart and Michael Weeks, who are new to the committee. In accordance with Council policy, this meeting is being audio recorded. Members of the public and the press may use their devices to film, photograph or do a sound recording of the meeting, but please let me know you are doing that so that I can inform all present. Please do not use flash and disable any sound notifications that may emit from your device. Members are reminded that any declarations of interest in respect of any business set out in the agenda should be declared as either a disclosable pecuniary interest or a declarable interest, and are required to notify the chair of the nature of any interest declared at the commencement of relevant item on the agenda. Members declaring a disclosable pecuniary interest must withdraw from the meeting for the duration of the item. Members declaring a declarable interest wishing to exercise a council speaking right must declare this at the same time as the interest, move to the public area before speaking to the item, and then must leave the room before the debate and the vote. Next item on the agenda is public participation, and I have no notice of that. So on we go then to agenda item six. So we're going to go through the papers that you've got on your tablets, and everybody is under strict instructions to name the page number that they're talking to and also not to use any acronyms. So we're going to do this in plain English, but I can hand over to you, Chris Woods.
Thank you, Chair. I'm going to do a quick introduction because there's only one member who may have met me in March. I'm Chris Wood. I'm the head of the Shared Internal Audit Service. You won't normally see me at these committees other than I like to drop in and say hello to all our partners. Mark Chalkley, your client's audit manager, who usually takes care of the audit plan here and attends this committee, is the proud father of a baby girl, Lydia Erin Chalkley, who was born last week. That's his second child, and he's currently on paternity leave. Would it be beneficial if I said 25 seconds on the Shared Internal Audit Service, or should I move swiftly? So the Shared Internal Audit Service was formed in 2011 from the County Council, Hertfordshire County Council, and seven districts and boroughs. it's almost easier to say the ones who don't belong in Hertfordshire rather than those who do, and those are Broxbourne, Decorum and St Albans. Otherwise, all Hertfordshire local authorities belong to our shared service. We've been pretty successful at what we do over the last 8 years, if I may say so, and are generally held in high regard by everyone I talk to. So I thought I'd get that plug in there as well. And if there are any questions on who we are, I'll dive straight into the agenda item. So each year we have to bring an annual assurance statement and internal audit annual report to all of our partner audit committees, and that's a requirement of the public sector internal audit standards, and it essentially summarises all of our audit work from our audit plan for the previous civic year, should we call it? And we are required to give an opinion based on all that work that then feeds into the council's annual governance statement, which you will see on a subsequent agenda item. And while I'm under instructions about acronyms, if I fall into using AGS, it's simply because trying to get that mouthful out every day in my day job, it just becomes the AGS. But the annual governance statement is what it is. The way I've been presenting this at other authorities is to deal with the what I call the simpler bits first. So on the cover of the report, which is page 15, one of the things that the audit committee has to do is accept our SIS audit charter, and bearing in mind I have to give page numbers, that's currently at Appendix D, which is all the way at the back of my report. And if anyone gets to a page number before I do, they're welcome to shout it out.
What are you looking for, Chris?
My charter. So page 30, there you go. I've accidentally made it 20% and couldn't even see it. So that the audit charter is something brought to this committee every year. It's our terms of reference. It sets out our authority and responsibilities and our position within the organisation. It's very similar to, in fact, it's almost exactly the same as all of our other partners. So one of the things we ask and we're required to do is for the audit committee to accept that on behalf of the authority each year. So no doubt that hopefully you'll take that decision. I'm going to spin all the way up to page 15 again, just to pick up the next thing that I need from this report. So one of the things we have to do in terms of the public sector internal audit standards is inform the audit committee of the results of our self-assessment against the public sector internal audit standards. And every year we do a self-assessment, and in every five-year cycle we also have an independent assessment of the service. Otherwise you could quite easily ask whether we were just happily giving ourselves the highest possible award, if you want. Nonetheless, as we do in page, so you'll see in section 2 from page 17, and particularly from paragraph 2.4 downwards, we are self-assessed as generally conforming. So that's basically the highest rating one can have, using the language of the public sector standards. And generally speaking, generally conforms means that we have a charter, we deliver in terms of that charter, we have all the right policies and processes in place, and conform with the requirements of the standards, and are therefore deemed to be an effective internal audit service. I think the next thing I wanted to do, which I need to draw one of my acting co-stars is Ian, and if you look at page 19, paragraph 210, one of the things I have to say to the audit committee is that there was nothing that threatened our independence in 2018-19, and that we weren't subject to any inappropriate scope or resource limitations. And one of the things the committee has to do, if you look at the cover of our report on page 15, is seek management assurance that our scope and resources were not subject to inappropriate limitations. So I've confirmed that from my point of view. And I will, with the chair's permission, ask Ian to confirm that on behalf of the authority.
I can confirm. I can confirm we did not impose any limitations of scope on Chris and Mark and their team. In fact, I actively encouraged them to find things and to look at things that they may have control weaknesses and to give us the best of their service they can.
Excellent. And I hope that will be minuted in the minutes because we need that formally recorded. And then drawing attention to paragraph 211, so I'm now on page 19 of the public agenda pack. There's a summary there at paragraph 211 of our overall assurance opinion for financial and non-financial systems. So we've given satisfactory for both, and our justification behind that is in section 3, so from across page 21 and page 22 of the pack. Just something to draw attention to the committee. There was a theme emerging from some of our limited assurance audit reports, and that was around partnership governance. So we've just written a short summary there, which, while not qualifying our opinion, is a theme that we'd like the authority to look at that emerged from our audit work.
And what paragraph are you referring to there?
So that's at page 310, page 22. Just provides a short summary of that. And the last thing I wanted to draw attention to before taking any questions is at section 4, so that's page 23 of the pack, there's a table there, and that just sets out our end of year performance against our performance targets in 2018-19. Hit the target for planned days, just a percentage short on the planned projects, and client satisfaction has been satisfactory or better for all those audits where a satisfaction survey was returned. So if I may take any questions at that point.
Thank you, Chris. Any questions, any comments? No. Okay, so the recommendations that have been set out then are that we note the annual assurance statement and internal audit annual report, that we note the results of the self-assessment that has been that is required, that we accept the charter, so the charter that was pointed out there being the kind of terms of reference, and that we seek the management assurance, which we have done. Is everybody happy to agree those recommendations?
Yep.
Yes. Yes, Kate. Unanimous. Do we need to record that? Good. Okay. Let's move on to the SIAS progress report then, please, Chris. Shared Internal Audit Service progress report, please, Chris.
Absolutely. Acronym in full. So just to let you know what this paper... I haven't popped that on, so I'll start that again. So the progress report, unlike the previous report, which is annual, the progress report comes to each audit committee. It's a summary of our delivery of the council's audit plan, sets out how we're doing against delivery of that plan, the audits that we've expected to deliver, how we're doing against our performance indicators during the year. So you'll see that one four times. We're quite early in the year at the moment, so obviously progress has only just commenced against that, but becomes more and more important to the committee as the year goes on, particularly as we get into Q3 and 4, and members would rightly be asking how we're doing against delivery of our audits. So that's a summary of what it's there for. Because it is so early in the year, the two areas I was going to draw attention to, just briefly look at page 41, paragraph 2.2. That just lays out all the final audit reports that have been issued since the last committee, which was the end of March, 21st of March to be exact. Key one to draw attention to there is the corporate debt management audit, which had a limited assurance and two high priority recommendations. And that links me into page 42. There's a section there which draws your attention to high priority recommendations. From a governance point of view, that's an area that audit committees should be focusing on. as any new high priority recommendations. Happen to have three there at the moment, one on museums and the two corporate debt ones. Usually we ask that the committee just keep an eye on implementation. Obviously there's a target date, and if the target date's in the future, then we can't obviously expect any action yet. But something to note is if, for example, you see target dates being extended and over a long period these recommendations aren't being implemented, that becomes of a concern just from a wider governance perspective, as well as us in internal audit. There may be very valid reasons for that, but that's where, as an audit committee, one might begin to ask questions of the action owners. And so the detail of the current recommendations, if I can find my 2.5 again, is at Appendix B, and I'll get you a page number as I spin down. Again, if anyone gets there before 48. I did, 48.
Yes.
And there it is. Slightly on the left-hand side because of the landscape. And the summary of the recommendations is contained there. So that's all I wanted to say on that paper and take any questions.
Okay, thank you. Are there any questions from
you? I'm just reading the recommendation. I had real trouble finding the page numbers on the side, of course.
It's on the side.
Yeah.
I read these earlier, actually, and didn't have any questions. Apart from one that you've already answered.
Yeah. Our original page numbers are down the bottom as we see them, and then the authority adds the one on the side because it has for the public agenda pack.
Okay. Any other questions?
I have a question, if I may. At what point would it be appropriate for us to then come back to you and check that there has been progress made on these high priority recommendations?
So through you, check.
Yeah.
The implementation date is there is the 31st of October 2019, and what should happen at each committee is there should be an update of progress, even if that date hasn't been reached. As a committee, you're probably expecting to see some form of progress because it's not going to be implemented on the 30th of October. The bit where the committee, in my view, hear a lot of discussion about audit committee effectiveness, is then once that implementation date has passed, so probably, I'm not sure when the next committee is, but let's say it would be in December, at that point you would be asking questions perhaps of, well, why hasn't that been implemented? Has there been a project setback, or has there been a, or actually is the project bigger than envisaged, or was the original implementation date actually not very realistic? But that's when the questions and the discussion may start to happen. But at the moment, that's a relatively new recommendation, so my advice, for what it's worth, to the committee is to note that it's there, and then to just keep an eye on the implementation and progress, particularly after the 31st of October. Sorry, rather long answer to probably a short question.
Can I comment? In response to that, thank you very much. If you feel that you're not going to meet that deadline, or is it a flexible deadline, are you then going to come, if the next committee isn't till after that, are you going to come to us in advance and say, I don't think we're going to meet this deadline? Or is it a question of literally waiting until after that and then asking why it hasn't been met, rather than having that some of that information in advance?
Okay, so through you, Chair, if I may.
Yeah, go on.
So we make the recommendation in our audit reports. That's been agreed by the action owners. The bit you're interested in is actually lies with management rather than audit, because they agreed to do something. Or at least we spotted, let's say, a weakness in control, and managers agreed with that because it's a final audit report. It's been to all the officers. They've said, yes, we'll do that. So actually, the accountability lies with officers, whoever that is. Our role is to draw that to your attention from a governance perspective so that you have awareness of that and can then follow up accordingly, but thankfully we don't always have to implement these things ourselves.
Mm-hmm. So can I ask Ian if, and maybe Amelia, I'm not sure who would do this, but if we can put that on the appropriate agendas, that we can come in and have a check on that?
Yeah, I'm happy to kind of also confirm that I do monitor the audit plan throughout the year as well. I will keep an eye on it. And as Chris said, there'll be regular reports anyway, but if there's anything to highlight outside of that cycle, I generally do it for the meeting rather than outside the meetings. That obviously gives you a chance to ask questions as appropriate. If there ever was a critical recommendation, which is the highest level, we haven't had one ever yet, that would obviously be such a level that if it wasn't meeting its dates, maybe that would be flagged to you outside the meeting. High priority recommendations, whilst important, aren't going to fundamentally affect how the authority operates, and therefore I tend to keep that on the report of the committee cycle.
Thank you. Satisfied?
Yes.
Thank you. Sam?
Thank you, Chair. It's a very quick question about on page 48, the recommendation section. And the recommendation reads, "We recommend that the Council undertakes training with all officers responsible for debt management and recovery." Can I ask what the scope of that is? So in terms of officers responsible for debt management and recovery, what do we mean by that? So is that, because I would have a, if we're minded to obviously approve this report, are we thinking of training the call centre operators, the senior managers, chief executives, or is this purely and simply just the officers who are within the recommended corporate debt management group, as it were, and how are we going to understand the definition between that? And then secondly, is this something that members need to be trained on as well?
So if I can just briefly summarise what the report found, which I think would probably be helpful to give some context. The authority has some fairly effective debt management processes in relation to the first period after a debt becomes overdue, in terms of sort of the standard chasing cycle of issuing letters and hoping people will pay or phone calls. After that point, there's one main route the debts take, and that is to refer back to the service area that to kind of provide the service in the first place. They're the ones that best know about what the debt relates to and the customers involved. In some instances, that requires the withdrawal of service. In others, it's a case of, for example, Careline around some soft prompting to make sure the debts are paid. Obviously, it's important the debts are paid. It is a service they need to pay for, but equally, we don't want to leave people at risk through not providing that service. And it's that bit that the audit report found wasn't working effectively, the referral back to service and the chasing at that point. And so therefore the recommendation relates to those particular members of staff in those sort of areas and making sure they're trained in the right approach to debt management when it gets to that stage.
Okay, so thank you. My query then is obviously if we are going to, is this something that we approve? And if so, do we need to state that a little bit more clearly in this rather than potentially leaving this open for...
As well. So the report is to be noted rather than approved, just to get a distinction in there. Sorry, I didn't ask permission, Chair. I'm not sure the protocols you like to follow. Some are very formal, but addressing Councillor North's question. Hence, it's to note and follow up on the things in here, but that recommendation is actually finalised, agreed by officers. They've agreed a plan of action. And it's almost what they've agreed to do in their management response that then becomes where the committee should focus. But yeah, that recommendation is now finalised. We've made it. It's been agreed by the authority, so there isn't strictly an approval of it by the committee. But the reason you note it is so that from a governance perspective, you follow up on it and keep an eye on it.
Can I ask Ian, is this clear enough internally among the officers and the people that are responsible?
Short answer, yes.
Thank you. Are you satisfied?
Yeah, thank you, Chair.
I think I would just like to ask a question around some of the previous conversations that we've had around ethical debt recovery. Was that taken into account when looking at what was needed? And are we in a position where we're saying what training is needed? I realise this might not be to monitoring it might go to another committee, but I don't know who can take that.
From memory, I don't believe this audit looked at ethical debt recovery. It was looking at how we recover money and whether the process we've got in place are being followed. Obviously, part of that, in terms of our process, does consider ethical debt recovery. And you'll note from the report, there are no recommendations made in respect of ethical debt recovery. The areas of concern were that the process we've got in place were not being adequately followed in some instances.
Right. Okay. Any further questions? So are we then happy to note the report for the period to 17th of May, note the proposed amendments to the audit plan, and note the implementation status of those high priority recommendations?
Yes, Chair.
Yes. Did it.
Thank you.
Now, Chris, one thing I didn't ask you is, are you hoping to leave after your bid?
I usually stay, particularly I'd like to stay for the annual governance statement on agenda item number 8, because it links into our work. As I was saying it earlier, our opinion follows in, but with your permission, I, especially because we've looked through the papers during your briefing prior to this meeting, if I may jump up and leave with your permission, that would be great. Thank you.
Right then, on to the draft annual governance statement then, and Reuben.
Thank you, Chair. This report is to bring the draft annual governance statement to the risk, or final, also, don't remember words up, sorry, Finance and Audit and Risk Committee, including the action plan. It is the recommendation to review and comment on the plan as it is, for it to be finalised for approval in July 2019, which is the next meeting. The annual governance statement is a legal requirement of which the NHDC have to review their requirements for good governance. They are the way we which we do it is set against a framework, which is the Delivering Good Governance and Local Government Framework, which has been published by the Chartered Institute of Public Finance and Accountancy and the Society of Local Authority Chief Executives and Senior Managers. There are 8 principles which are outlined at the end of Appendix A. I'll just run through the report now, but that sets the tone for what we're doing and why we're here. So, to start, it is the committee. The committee is the legal body with responsibility to approve the statement. And to give you some background there, at section 7, that it must be considered by the members of this committee and approved, which will be in July, against the framework as I outlined. At 7.3, it talks about the work that we did to get this document to this committee today.
Reuben, what page are you on?
That's on page 56, sorry.
56.
At 7.3, senior management group sits down and assesses all of the work that's done about what we've done in the previous financial year, and there are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 levels of assurance level there. And then at 7.4 it says that the actual statement itself, as Appendix A, should be a meaningful but brief communication. So although the assessment they did with SMT ran to 97 pages, this runs to a shorter 6. So it captures the highlights but not everything. But that assessment document will be published as well alongside this statement. 7.5, and picking up Chris's point here, that there is a key element of the review of effectiveness that hasn't been included yet because it got presented just a second. I don't get to see that report until today. But for the July report, I'll incorporate the work that Chris has prepared today. 8.1 talks about the relevant considerations, so that talks about the self-assessment. And the review that will happen today. At 8.4, it talks that when SMT concluded their assessment, they gave a substantial assurance level. Any actions that they picked up there would be a part of the action plan, which I'll come to in a bit. Which I'll come to it now. So moving on to page 60, that outlines first on the first page, on page 61, the introduction, delivering good governance and the eight principles there, the key elements of the governance framework, and then the next page that follows show how we comply with that governance framework against each of the eight principles, starting with principle A all the way to principle G. And the very last page on page 67 talks about the action plan for the forthcoming year, and there are eight actions there that I will monitor and update the committee throughout the civic year.
Okay, our page numbers might have got a bit mixed up.
Apologies.
So I have page 62 blank.
I think it's a formatting thing.
Okay.
I have to deal with that for the next committee meeting. Happy to take any questions.
Good. Sam?
I have a question. It's actually more of a jurisdiction question.
Okay.
Just because some of the stuff in here, I'm also on the Overview and Scrutiny Committee, and quite a lot of this crosses over into the realms of Overview and Scrutiny as well. I've just noticed that's not on tomorrow's agenda. Is that a standard thing that it wouldn't go to Overview and Scrutiny, even though it covers off quite a lot of Overview and Scrutiny areas? This is more for my own information, actually, than anything.
The FAR is the statutory committee for approval of the annual governance statement, and we try to avoid, wherever possible, crossover between FAR and Overview and Scrutiny. So, therefore, as the statutory committee, it comes here and not to Overview and Scrutiny.
Thank you.
And Scrutiny would have they could have a look at it if they wanted to.
I've already looked at it now. Sorry, that's my question.
A lot of questions. Yes, go on.
Just an observation from myself. So Reuben mentioned that the eight matters in the action plan on page 68 are brought back to this committee twice a year in the same manner as our high priority audit recommendations. One of the things from a good governance point of view is that members also monitor the delivery of that particular action plan and just keep an eye on how those are going. Hence why it's brought back here twice a year. But again, I just felt I should get that in there. That's what effective audit committees will be asking. Those are the challenging questions to ask.
Any other questions? I have some. So, number five on the action plan, area committee grants criteria to be reviewed. Where has that come from within the report? Can you pinpoint that?
I think that came from the Determined Labour Party administration agreement.
Pardon?
I think that was part of the administration agreement.
Oh, was it?
Yeah.
Okay, right, that's fine. Is that why it's sitting in there, Ruben?
It's a look at the whole of what we do across the piece. So, like, for example, the gender pay gap thing, there's one particular place where it would get reported to. So in this respect, I put it in there because it's something that is going to happen and it's a financial thing. So it's a good place to sit as any.
Yeah.
Just to demonstrate that we're doing something.
The gender pay gap was my next one.
Yes.
In terms of the action plan from there. Can we see that?
That's online now.
That's online.
That gets end of March or April.
Okay. Thank you.
I can provide a link if you need one.
Could you put a link on my up?
Yep.
Thank you. Okay. Any further questions?
Not a question, not a lot of questions, a statement. So just to confirm that at the next meeting, end of July, we need to approve this annual governance statement, so I bring a draft to you now. Also at the same time, we'll be approving this statement of accounts. They were issued on the 30th of May, last week, and They're on the website. I will be sending around a link to you. They will be subject to audit by external auditors in time for the next meeting, but you'll be asked to approve those. So if you can have a look at them, it's a long document, but if you do have any questions about it, then please come back to me before the next meeting, so I can try and answer them or get it changed if need be before then.
So again, what we're going to do is put a link on ModGov so that we're pushing all this stuff through ModGov, but it's a publicly available document, so it's important that we come to the next meeting with a really good knowledge of that and any questions that we might have. And yeah, thank you for your offer of fielding those questions prior to that meeting. I think that would make that a lot easier. Good. Any further questions for Ruben? No? All right then. Are we then, as a committee, happy what does it ask us to do? Review and comment on the draft in order for it to be finalised. So this will be going to Cabinet next?
It will come back here first.
Come back here first in July. Okay. Are you happy given that there's been limited challenge?
Yes.
Yes. All right. Everybody's happy. Good. Thank you very much. Thank you for input. And I take it you probably would like to skip off now.
I might hang around.
Oh, you're going to hang around too?
I may stay for a little longer, thank you.
Okay.
Thank you. Just me then. Thank you, and I wish you all a good evening. Thank you.
Thank you.
Right. So, we've got, Ian, you're next. The annual report, item 9, pages 69 to 74.
Thank you, Chair. So this is a report we do annually, it's an annual report, and it summarises what this committee does, this case, for the last year, and it is reported to full council, subject to approval here of the report, to let full council know what the committee's been up to. As you'll note, on page 73 onwards, it takes you through all the work committee's done during last year. A lot of it is a regular cycle and linked to the terms of reference of the committee and its statutory requirements, which include approval of the statement of accounts and approval of the annual government statement. Those two statutory things this committee has to do. And then at the bottom of page 74 is a brief summary about upcoming work of the committee during this year. And in that, it mentions both the one thing that I know or I plan to come to this committee during the year, in addition to sort of the standard routine things, which is a new fraud prevention policy, which takes the current fraud prevention policy and hopefully makes it a bit simpler. But that's coming back to you for your review and hopeful approval before being filled onto Cabinet. And also in that same bit at the bottom of page 74, is my offer in relation to training. I'm aware that there are a number of new members of this committee, and what I am planning to do, and I've spoken to the Chair about this with her permission, at the end of the meeting, is to hand out a short questionnaire stroke matrix and ask to fill it in before you leave tonight. It will not take you long, just so I can get a view of what you know and what you don't know about what this committee does. And then from that, my plan is to develop a training programme aiming to make that as light touch as possible. Where I can, I'll do that through written stroke e-learning, but if there is a need for face-to-face kind of training, happy to do that one-to-one if that works better rather than doing group training, given that group training will tend to have to be in the evening, which probably neither of us want in terms of timing. So with the Chair's mission, that at the end of the meeting. What I also highlight in there is that the risk management group meet on a quarterly basis in advance of this meeting. That is during the day. It's a meeting attended both by myself as the officer risk champion, Councillor Albert as the member risk champion, and it does go into sort of some detailed review of risks. And the output of that does come to this meeting, but members of this committee are always invited to that meeting, and I will circulate dates of those meetings as I know what they are. And would welcome any of you to come along to those. They usually have quite an informative and interesting discussion coming out of it, and it, the more the merrier in terms of that discussion. So that's kind of the plug for this coming year, but the fundamental part of the report is to review what happened last year, aware that only Chair was actually part of the committee last year, so it may fall on her to do most of the approval of that report, but that's what the report shows.
I'm happy to approve the report, but I also want to stress in there the action plan, so that unlike Chris and Ruben, who we were trying to kick out, but don't worry, you can stay for a while, you're not allowed to leave until you've done it. It's one page, and even subs, I think it's a really, really good opportunity to just kind of put some of those training needs in, and I think even if we think we know stuff, it's good to do it, and Ian's really kindly offered to do that kind of one-to-one as well at a talent success, so that's brilliant. So yeah, I can't stress enough how important that is, but yes, happy to approve the report, being the only person that was here last year. Okay, good. Let's move to item 10, revenue budget outturn. Ian, do you want to just give us a bit of bracing on what this is?
Yes, Chair. So revenue is the spend on everyday items, the opposite of capital expenditure, which is a big things that last more on year. Revenue spend is the most of what we do. We do a bit of capital, as you find on next report, most of it's revenue. And this is the position for the year that ended the 31st of March 2019. And it informs you what we spent, what we spent it on, and where there were variances to the budget. Under the financial regulations, I am required to report to you and Cabinet on any variances that exceed £25,000 against the working budget, which is the budget at the current time. So throughout the year, we do quarterly reports, and each time we bring a quarterly report, we'll amend the budget, so we're not reporting the same thing to you more than once. Once we've reported it, it's kind of been and gone, we reset the budget, they report against that new budget. And so, as you'll see in paragraph 1.1, which provides a decent summary of the entire report, there is a £555,000 decrease compared to the working budget. A lot of that relates to activities that we'd hoped to get finished during the year, but we didn't quite, and therefore we're seeking to carry forward £474,000 of that. The remainder is things that just we just spent less on than we thought we would, and there's nothing, you know, there's no carry forward in respect of those. Please be reassured that carry forwards are by no means an easy thing to get. They'll be scrutinised by me if I don't think they're actually real projects that are carrying on. They will not even be allowed to report, let alone get close to you. In addition, I'll also report to you throughout the year for variances under £25,000, which are where I feel there's a good reason to report them to you, but there's some kind of something behind it that kind of is an underlying issue or something that feels relevant. So going into the report and diving into it, main area of focus is on table 3, which starts on page 78, and those are the big variances, differences between spend and budget, and they're there. I'm not going to go through each of them in turn. Hopefully the re-explanation in the fourth paragraph gives you a good overview. If there are any detailed questions over them, I'll have to take them at the end, but I'd rather do that rather than bore you by going reading basically what's there. I can go into more detail on some of them, and if I can't, I'll get you an answer if you need it. And then the other thing I was going to flag is in paragraph 3.15, so the section starting at 3.11 onwards looks at our funding. So there's one side of the equation, which is the first part of the report, which is where we spend our money, but the other part is where we get our money from, and we have uncertainty as to what we're going to spend in terms of there are variances. We also get variances in our funding as well. We don't get a set amount of money, we just spend it. We do collect council tax, we collect business rates, and there are variations in terms of how much we get depending on how much we collect. During last year, during 2018-19, we were part of a business rates pool with some of the other local authorities in Hertfordshire. What that is, in the briefest terms I can put it in, is that it's an arrangement put forward by central government whereby groups of authorities can join together to take advantage of where business rates go up to a small degree. At the same time, we do take up on increased risk if business rates go down. Luckily, business rates did go up as we expected and forecast they would do, and that puts in a better position to the tune of £368,000, and that's in 3.15. what the report, that paragraph also says, is that money has gone into one of our specific reserves. A specific reserve is money set aside for a specific purpose, and it is in that reserve, but there is potential in the future that that funding could be used for general fund, i.e. more general purposes than just sitting in that reserve. It's not going to be needed for the rest of what that reserve is set aside there for. And I suppose on that basis I should highlight that table 8, page 87 and 88, is a list of all those specific, or also known as earmarked reserves, and that's money set aside for particular purposes. In respect to support, it all gets referred on to Cabinet. That particular element, table 8, requires approval by full council. So after Cabinet, that bit of the report will go to full council for approval. That is a summary of the report. I haven't gone through everything, but happy to take questions about any of the report. Just want to highlight the key bits from my perspective.
Thank you.
You said my name before I'd even pressed the button. It's my finger going. It's more of a thing I think might be worth noting, or at least if my reading of this is correct. It's predictably to do with bins. And page 80, the table on page 80 was the bottom of it, but the waste services client team staffing variance, the waste service contract variance, waste service contract variation orders variance, and the waste service income from paper recycling variance, I feel the last one, the 27,000 there, is probably because nobody's recycling got collected in that period, so that would probably explain the drop, and then it would also have an impact on the other two that I've put there, because there were the issues last year, and so it surely we'd expect a drop in the amount of paper being recycled, because you can't recycle what people haven't collected. Is that the right judgment?
I don't think that's the... because I think most of that is due to the fact that the amount of paper that people have in the first place is declining. People are buying less newspapers, less printed media, therefore there's less to recycle. I think that overall most of the waste, I'm not going into waste collection issues, it's not my area, most of the waste eventually got into the waste stream and got collected, without it going into other streams, such as household waste recycling centres, and that's the reason we're forecasting the same amounts, albeit different by £1,000, that's just due to the changing contract values during the year. Going into next year, we can see it's a continuing trend, and it could get worse, potentially, in terms of there could be a further decline in those paper volumes. People just aren't buying papers and things, so therefore they don't have to recycle them.
So do you think other local authorities are showing the same decline? So
yes.
Yeah.
Okay. Declines, yeah.
Question answered.
And to be clear, this is just paper that is being referred to there, isn't it?
Yes, that's just paper. We've reported other variances in the past around other commingled streams. That's the bit that goes in the big bin, and that's due to reductions in the income or increase in the cost we have to pay to get rid of that recycling. And that's linked primarily due to the Far East market and their reluctance to take on those products anymore. So it's a general trend, is that income or is going down, or where we have to pay to get rid of that that waste, the costs are going up. Albeit all those costs are still less than what it would cost to which go into landfill or other residual waste streams.
Thank you. Sam?
Thank you, Chair. More of a question about the remit of this committee is a slight concern that I have in terms of the Brexit preparations section. And my concern is there that we haven't spent anything.
Page
82. Is my concern is that we haven't spent anything. And in the council's risk assessment, it's seen as a high risk. So I'd just like to know who is responsible for Brexit preparations, and where we can find out more information about what these specific costs relating to Brexit could be, and thirdly, why they haven't spent any money yet, if possible.
I'm right in thinking it's a category 9, aren't I? Mm.
Yeah,
that's what it says.
Answer best of my abilities. The central government gave us, as referred to there, £17,500 of funding in 1819. That was given to us towards the end of the year. I think from memory in March, maybe in end of February. We have spent what we think it was sensible to spend, bearing in mind that at that point the uncertainty in relation to Brexit was huge, and we did not want to spend money just for the sake of spending money. We could have spent all our consultants and been in no better position than we are today. And that's not coming on the general Brexit-ness. It's just a case of we're spending it as we see there's opportunity to spend it where it makes sense to. We are doing work at officer level to look at the implications of Brexit, but that has not involved actually spending any money externally. It's taken a lot of officer time, but not spent money externally. As and when there is a need to spend money externally, that funding is there alongside another tranche of the same amount related to 1920, and we carry the full money forward into 2019-20, plus we'll get the extra another £17,500 for 1920 on top. We will spend it as we see fit. The responsibility for Brexit has been taken on by the Service Director for Legal and Community in answer to that bit of the question.
So in terms of, obviously you mentioned it is taking up people's time and that is costing money. So my first question in terms of that is, why do we not include that in this, and why do we include that in, because quite clearly that is, they are being used specifically for Brexit preparations. And secondly, what is the definition of these specific costs relating to Brexit? Is that once we potentially could have left, or is that something in terms of when we actually know whether we're going to leave or not?
So in terms of grants, the general rule is you only account for actual external spend in relation to grants. You don't apportion existing staff costs to them. That's why we're not showing those costs. You know, we spend staff time on all sorts of things, and it's what we expect to spend our time doing, and then there's changes to that, and Brexit is one of those things that's changed, but we wouldn't then start apportioning costs to it in terms of allocating it to a grant. In terms of when will we spend the money, that will depend on when there is, I suppose, appropriate certainty or uncertainty that makes it worth spending the money. Where we know, if we know something's going to happen, we need to prepare for it, we'll definitely spend money on that. If we think there's value in scoping out various scenarios in relation to degrees of uncertainty, we'll spend money on that. But as I said before, the key is to only spend money where we think there is value in spending it. Spending money on consultants, I do not think is good value for money, unless they're going to add some value. And at the moment, we can't see any value they'd add in terms of what we're doing.
Okay, thank you.
Okay.
Thank you. I was going to ask some of the questions that Sam has just asked, which you just answered. But in terms of internal resources that are being spent on preparations for Brexit, which is effectively what we're doing as opposed to using grant money, where is that recorded? And is that something that comes to us? So is it something that we are able to see what the spend on internal resources and staff time is on this? Because obviously, if we're not using grant money for it, it's staff time, so it's still a cost to us that isn't something that we would normally be doing. So how is that recorded, and when did we find out about it?
It's probably not recorded. It will be bits of time here and there across a large number of people, and senior managers spending time discussing it at senior management team meetings, as an example. We generally have tried to move away from recording time like that, because you spend more time spending money recording your time saying what you're doing than you're spending sort of another layer on top of it. You spend the time doing the stuff you were expecting to, then you spend the time recording what time you spent doing it. We found that wasn't kind of really effective use of resources overall. And because it's kind of existing money that's already been spent, we just sort of deal with it, I guess, as officers. It does get more and more difficult to do that. Our Our headcount is reducing, the number of staff we employ is reducing, it has reduced over time. It does make it more difficult to deal with these things, but generally we do just get on with it.
Okay, can I ask? So if, for example, we wanted to speak to the public and say this is how much Brexit preparations have already cost us out of our budget, how do we do that? Have you got a sort of, you know, like an estimated figure that's something that can go forward? Because people are genuinely interested to know that. And I think it's something that we want to be able to say. If it's just little bits of time here and there, that's surely going to increase as things get more involved and closer to the deadline. So, for my residents particularly, it is something that I want to be able to say to them, this is how much this has cost the council so far.
Honestly, I don't know. It would require work to do to find that answer out. And again, it would require people just guessing about how much time they spent. We don't have sort of detailed time recording systems in place. If I was honest with you, I'd say it probably at this stage be more cost to try and find that answer out than it'd be worth doing it. I agree with you that as we get closer to whatever the outcome might be, there will be more time spent on it, I would imagine. And some of that will then become external spend and will be spent against those budgets, and then we can start to give a more realistic picture. But I would just be guessing at this stage, trying to give you an answer.
Ian, can I come in on that and just ask around the protection that we've got in place for staff? Because what you've described there is extra workload, no extra resource, no idea of how much extra workload versus the no extra resource, which is always going to be a concern and is only going to increase, we think. So do we have a plan, given that it's Category 9, we're going to need, there may come a point where we'll need another person in, or we have a consultant lined up that we know can do what we need, even though we're not really sure what we need?
Yeah, I mean, as a senior management team and chief executive as head of paid service, we'd always keep under review where there was a need for additional resource, and we would react to that as we needed to. As you say, we don't know what we need at the moment. There's no point getting people lined up until we know what we need. There is an example there of the £500. That was a contribution to an initiative across the Hertfordshire authorities, and therefore, whilst a small amount of money, it went a lot further than that would imply, and that's part of what it is about making best use of the money we are spending. To get the best outcomes and be as prepared as we can. As it develops, yes, we will probably need to take on additional resource, probably, and we'll fund it from here, or fund it from more budgets if we need to spend more budgets to care and delivering services. But until we know what it is, and there's huge uncertainty over that, as I'm sure you're aware, there's no point spending it.
And we'll have an opportunity to review the risk matrix at the next meeting, so we can have perhaps we can further this discussion then.
We could do it.
Sam?
I seem to have got the magic button, I'm sorry. I pushed the speak to request and just switched on. It's a very simple question. You've got the 18 grand in the last financial year, 18 grand or the last civic year, then 18 grand this civic year. If Brexit doesn't happen, can we keep that money?
yes.
I think Sam's actually covered my question. My question was going to be that we have a pot of money there for something that is, in my view, a national catastrophe that is being imposed on us. And it would be, obviously it's not the normal thing that we do, but it would be quite nice if we are being given the grant money to allocate that, so that at least we are using that money anyway. But if we are likely to have that grant funding at the end of that, then it's probably worthwhile not spending it until we know what happens. But thank you.
I think you're wholeheartedly agreeing with Ian.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, good. And I think that we, you said at the beginning of that was, I'm not sure if it's in our remit, and I think if we want to try and fix Brexit, it's not in our
room.
Let's not do that tonight.
£18,000, let's fix Brexit.
£18,000. All right, so where were we at with that? We were to receive the report. No? To consider the recommendations on page 75. Is that right? Or am I not on the right bank there?
Yeah, you're on
So the only recommendations are, oh, there's a summary position, so pages 75, just a second. So we're going to note this report, approve a decrease of 550k.
It's all cabinet.
All the recommendations are for cabinet. It is for this committee to provide any comments it wishes to cabinet. You are free to make no comments if you wish to, or you're free to make any comments you want to cabinet.
Okay. So I think if we can pick up what we've discussed about Brexit and kind of spending, not spending, an agreement on that.
So no Brexit. So 40 grand.
Give them 18 grand. We would like cabinet to take that 18 grand and fix Brexit. That's what our note would
be. Two times 18 grand. 40, that's right, 40 grand windfall for council if we don't have Brexit. I think it's a great argument.
just take that out to the...
Right, okay. Everybody happy with that? Let's move on to item 11, pages 91 to 110. Back to you, Ian.
Thank you. Unfortunately, I get bored of standing in these meetings. I tend to always have the last items, but I tend to talk about them. So this is capital. This is spending on generally things you can kick, solid things that last, have a useful life of more than 1 year. That's the definition of capital. This is the end of year position against the working budget. And the summary is basically in two tables. There's table 2 on page 93, which describes the two areas where there's been significant slippage, a reprogramming of budget into the following year. So the top one, providing housing at market rents. We've got a plan, more than a plan at the moment, to convert Harkness Court, but it was used by Careline in Hitchin. It was formerly residential, it was converted to office. We now want to convert it back to residential again, to four flats. We made a rough estimate before we even started of allocating £500,000 to potentially the cost of that redevelopment. Thus far, we've spent £18,000 on basically planning and building control work, and have now received an estimate of £210,000 for the actual building work. The actual building work hasn't happened at the end of the year and is still hasn't happened quite yet, but it's the final loads and details of tender. So that just describes that we want to carry that time money forward. We'll only spend about £230,000 in total on Harkness Court, but that is part of a wider pot of £3 million, which is set aside by full council for the purchase of purchase development or building of house, providing housing at market rent. So that will go into other schemes as they come forward and can be justified. The bottom one there relates to the North Harts Museum. And the plan was to spend it during 2018-19. The acquisition of 1415 Brown Street was an integral part of that. That has now been resolved, as I'm sure you're aware. But in terms of spending the money, it couldn't be spent until that had been resolved, and so therefore that will slip into the early part of this year. But the plan is that the museum and town hall, the museum will be fully open by the end of June, beginning of July of this year. And then the other table to draw your attention to is table 3 on page 94, and that's two areas where the spend is less in 2018-19 than was forecast. There's no plans to or request to carry that money forward. In relation to the Disabled Facilities Grant, the bottom item on that table, there are sort of two elements to that. Firstly, the number of applications is less than it has been, and secondly, there have been some issues with the Home Improvement Agency, which is a partnership arrangement hosted by the County Council, which a number of districts are part of, which has experienced some problems in terms of getting the throughput of where applications are made, getting the actual work completed. That is being addressed quite seriously. It was subject of a shared internal audit service review, and there's an action plan in place to get that rectified because we realise the importance of getting that work done for those making those applications for those grants. Being taken very seriously. The reason that that agency or partnership arrangement was formed in the first place was to provide resilience and greater linkages to the occupational therapist service at the County Council, so it's really important that does work effectively. And the top one on that table relates to waste and street cleansing vehicles. We pay the contractor to provide the waste collection service. As part of that, they use a number of vehicles. Of those vehicles, for the ones that they use pretty much for the entire life of the contract, under accounting rules, we are required to capitalise those vehicles because we have to reflect that we are using them in effect. They're being used for our services, and this is the element of that we need to capitalise against that budget and show as a capital cost. The 3.6 million was an estimate at the start of the contract, so it's going to be a bit less than that, which is partly due to efficiency and use of vehicles and partly because they're using more short-term use of vehicles than we were expecting. They're using it for short term. We show them as capital costs because they're just hiring them on a sort of ad hoc arrangement. So that's the reason for the variance on that one. They're the big movements in respect of capital. Happy to take more detailed questions, but that's where I want to end the summary of the report. And again, these recommendations in 2.1 to 2.4 on page 91 are all for Cabinet, and you as a committee are asked to kind of comment to Cabinet and provide that kind of, as Councillor Aspinall said at the start, a kind of supportive, critical friend, and just provide any comments you feel suitable.
Thank you. Okay.
Thank you. With regards to the waste and street cleansing vehicles, that estimate that was put aside for capital expenditure on these, was that earmarked specifically for that? In which case, if it hasn't been spent, is it just going back into the general pot? Or will it be carried over because we think there's going to be a higher spend next year? Or could it, for example, be put to better use within that portfolio?
It goes back into the general pot and will be subject to capital bids, which will go through the capital budget setting process, which will go through to full council in February. So through that entire process, always welcome requests for spending of that money or not spending it, depending as the priorities lie.
Thank you.
Sam? Yeah, I do go for the magic button tonight. It's on the same subject, actually, as Kay was asking about. Obviously, we've got this 3.1 mil that's been spent on bin trucks. Just, I was a little bit unclear on it. Do we own them, or does the contractor own those bin trucks? Or are they leased? I'm not quite clear on the arrangements with these vehicles.
The contractor leases them from a leasing company. But without getting into too much detail, under accounting rules, it's around effective control of those vehicles. So they are on long-term leases, and we basically dictate how they're used in terms of we set the rounds or the scope of collecting waste, and therefore, under those accounting kind of rules and regulations, we are required to show them as our asset. Even though we do not own them, they are owned by the leasing company, but in effect, we sort of own them in that context.
And did so that 3.1 million on this account, did that ever actually leave a North Hearts bank account, or did that leave a contractor's bank account and it is part of the wider contract?
We will pay for those vehicles over the life of the contract through the amount we pay to Abaser, which is already reflected in the revenue budgets. This is kind of swapping some of that revenue cost for capital cost as required by accounting rules.
So that 422,000 that Kay was talking about is spread across the life of the contract. It's not a one-off hit.
The difference between what we've accounted for as capital spend and the capital budget is an additional capital budget, so it goes back into the capital funding account, and we can use it on other capital spend from any time from now, basically.
Sam. I was going to press it. I'm thinking.
Samuel, sorry.
Thank you, Chair. Page 93, table 2. This, again, forgive me if it is outside of the remit of this committee. However, under the provide housing at market rents, on the comments it says work is in progress to redevelop a council office, planning permission, blah, blah, blah. And then it says estimated spend is £208,000 after receiving tenders. Now, the decision to renovate and change this property into different use was made obviously by the previous administration. And I was just wondering as to whether we could have a look or whether we were able to see the tender process, because quite clearly in the time that we're in, tenders are accepted on due to different reasons. And the tender that comes back stating that we'll be spending £208,000 next year, in to me sounds like quite a lot. I don't know Harkness Court, so I don't know how much work needs to be done. But I was just wondering as to whether we scrutinise those tenders at all, bearing in mind it's £208,000 of public money, or what the process is to ensure that tender process is as good value for money as possible. And I know there probably is a process within the office's remit, but whether the Finance Audit Risk Committee ever sees that or scrutinises that.
That would fall into the member officer protocol. The review on tenders and deciding which tender to take would be taken by officers. It would not be an area members should or would get involved in. You could have a role in terms of determining whether our contracting processes were reasonable in general, and that could be through your review, which is part of your remit of reviewing the contracts procurement regulations. I suppose aligned to that, there would have been a budget set aside for that. If it had exceeded that budget, it would get reported back here, and in relation to capital, subject to it being above a certain degree of variance, the project would stop until the point it was approved by Cabinet to carry on. That was not breached in this context, and therefore it wouldn't be a remit for this group to this committee to review that.
Okay, thank you.
And who sets those kind of rules?
Full council set those rules in terms of agreeing the financial regulations, which they do on a regular basis as they are brought to them.
Thank you. All right, any other questions? Sam Collins, you just look so expectant all the time. I think you're going to say something.
That's just my face.
I don't know what. It's just your face. Okay, so are we happy to note the recommendations? Send them on?
Yep.
Great. All right. That was item 11. Let's move on to item 12. Ruben, are you doing all right there? You don't want to jump
in? Fine, thank you. It's very informative, thank you. Chair.
Ruben's going, not what are you asking this question?
Right then, Ian, annual treasury management review.
Thank you, Chair. This is a report on where we have cash, which we do have cash, which is, I suppose, a combination of our capital reserves, so where we've got capital funding we haven't spent yet, also our general fund balance, which is the amount of money we have to sort of have for general usage, which we keep hold of, and also those specific reserves, earmark reserves I talked about earlier. All of that adds up to, as well as money that comes in and out in terms of cash flow. You will note we collect business rates and council tax on behalf of central government and Hertfordshire County Council, amongst others. All that money is there, and we make best use of it to invest it to get a return on that money, subject to ensuring that our money is kept safe and secure. We don't take undue risks with where it's invested. To do that, we set a Treasury strategy at the start of the year, which is approved by the full council at a meeting in February. And this report is for the end of year, the end of 2018-19, and reports to you a combination of, have we kept to those sort of treasury indicators, have we made sure it's invested within that, within those rules to keep it safe and secure, and how much income have we generated in terms of the interest rates we've achieved. And as summarised in 1.1, we've achieved slightly less than the working budget as at the end of the year, albeit that budget has been increased during the year as we have achieved more than the original budget we set right at the start of the year for interest received. And that reflects that we have achieved a slightly better percentage return, but also where capital projects get delayed, that means the money's there for longer, and therefore we can spend, we can invest more of that money and therefore get more return through that way as well. Also to confirm, as is highlighted in the exit summary, we have kept within those prudential and treasury indicators, we've kept the rules, and that's basically the summary of the report really. You'll note that, to go a bit more detail in the report, and you also got the treasury management review, which is started on page 117, which is the longer documents attached, and that goes into the full detail. I'm not going to go through that line by line, but if you do have any questions on any of it, please ask.
I will go first then. Just draw to your attention to the bit that jumped off my screen, because I've got one of these lovely old tablets. It's more a question just for my own interest, and it's following on a theme of the evening. On page 121, the investment portfolio, we've got a chunk of cash there, but if I understand it, 32 million stuck away in various building sites, banks, local authorities, and money market funds. Now, there is a lot of discussion about the state of the British economy in the event of a no-deal Brexit or any form of Brexit, depending on who you listen to. I think it's going to be an absolute disaster if it happens, but I would say that. What measures, and this is something perhaps we could recommend as this committee to Cabinet to look into, because I don't think it's something we can do here, but perhaps it could be something that could be recommended to Cabinet. What measures and what protections do we have in place in case 2008 happens again, the economy tanks and the pound crashes, and maybe some of these building societies which have got 18 million on go the way of Northern Rock, etc. How protected are we? Because it does look like we're a little bit exposed.
Go on, Ian.
We get protection by ensuring that our money is diversified. So we try to spread where we hold our money, and you'll see that we have a mix of where we have money, and that mix is improving. So you'll notice as at the 31st of March 2018, we had 18 million, which is, I suppose, the lion's share of our money in building societies, at the 32.8 million. There probably is a slightly better mix as at the 31st of March 2019, that has continued throughout the beginning of this year. The treasury strategy we have set for this year, 2019-20, which wasn't in place last year, by definition, does allow now increased, well, has allowed investment at all in foreign banks outside the UK, which provides another source of diversification. In the event of the economy going completely wrong, we ensure for building sites in particular, they have assets to back up our investments in them. So our investment is part of a wider portfolio, and therefore there is fundamentally cash there that is being wisely invested by that building society. The balance sheet stacks up from that perspective, and therefore they should be able to, even if things go a bit wrong, be able to repay their borrowing. We'd never have absolute protection, and we do take on slightly greater risk in relation to building societies than some other authorities do. We do invest in the smaller building societies, which do not have a credit rating, but we do look at their reports in terms of their financial position and take a view as to whether they provide protection in that respect.
Doesn't fill me with huge confidence, and it's not me saying I don't know. I'm questioning what you're doing. It's just, obviously, there is this huge volatility and unpredictability, particularly in the UK. We're more exposed than, say, perhaps the euro markets or the Swiss franc, which look like they're going to be more stable going forward. But also, small building societies look like the ones who are most at risk. And I think if we'd had this conversation... Actually, as an interest, you might not know the answer to this. I'm not sure if you were here then. But in 2008, did this council have any investments in any of the banks that were hit by the Icelandic situation or Northern Rock or those similar ones?
We didn't have any investments in Icelandic banks, and in Northern Rock either, but that was really bailed out by the government. We are not allowed to invest in currencies other than pound sterling, so it never be an option for us to invest in other currencies and get that protection that may provide. Obviously, that with that comes exchange rate risk, which we're not allowed to deal with. My view is that we have good diversification of investments, and that we put controls in place to ensure that where we invest our money is kept as safe as it can be. The only other option would be invest it all with central government, which is the lowest risk possible but gives no return whatsoever on investments. And whilst Brexit may or may not be a bad thing, I don't feel it would lead to, maybe regret saying this, I do not think it will lead to the collapse of the whole financial system in this country, and therefore lead to all of our banks and building societies going to the wall, and therefore the risk of foregoing that interest in for that maximum protection, I think, is one worth taking.
Did you want to put forward a recommendation to Cabinet?
That's the three you will to decide as well.
Okay. Was that Sam North? Sorry.
Thank you, Chair. Ian, sorry to bombard you with so many questions, but I have a very similar question to Sam, but almost the complete opposite. And it may be a very quick answer. In the investment portfolio, it's saying that we're investing £9 million in local authorities, including Slough Borough Council, and I believe it was Lancashire. My question is, do we have anyone else investing in us? Any other councils investing in us? That's my first question.
No, it's not. No, because we do not borrow any money. We've got some historic borrowing from the Public Works Loan Board, which is central government. We have no current borrowing, which would be what that kind of short term borrowing would be for those investments from other local authorities.
Okay. And secondly, what are we giving Slough Borough Council £3 million for, and Lancashire County Council £2 million for?
They need money. They need some cash to fund their capital programme or to fund their cash flow. We give them the money for a set period of time. They give us the money back at the end of that period of time with interest. Simple as that. It's not an investment in the council. It's an investment that's placed with them.
Okay. Yeah, because I think that probably follows on from Sam's comment slightly, is that, okay, clearly in order for councils to function, they need borrowing. But again, do we expose ourselves by giving a council that can't find its own money and giving them £3 million? Because I know that there's a lot of things going on in Slough at the moment that could be deemed as quite risky ventures. And are we exposing ourselves to issues in terms of that? But I mean, I don't need an answer for that. It's just a comment that I'd like to put forward to Cabinet. But thank you.
Would you like to?
Happy to answer it. It's not the council can't generate its own money. It's a case of all local authorities have the power to borrow for capital purposes. We are very fortunate in terms of we don't have to borrow for capital, because we got a lot of money when we transferred a housing stock over to Northwest Homes back in 2003, and we have sold land since. It also generates capital receipts, which we've spent on delivering our capital programme. That's a fortunate position. Most councils do borrow money to fund their capital programme, and they will do that as we would require to if we were doing it, to make sure it is affordable, prudent and sustainable. They will have a treasury plan that will show that it is that in that regard, and there are various legislation to ensure that happens. I would say overall investments in local authorities are very low risk, in fact better low risk than in banks and building societies. They're governed by statute and setting a balanced budget each year. So yes, they borrow money for capital purposes, not for revenue purposes. They're reliable from a revenue perspective. They have, similar to us, required to have a general fund balance. They've got to keep it at a minimum level, as well as reserves, all those kind of things, to keep them sustainable, ongoing.
Thank you.
Morgan, did you want to say something?
Sam asked the question I was going to ask.
It's following on the same things. I'm a bit surprised you said sort of local authority is a safe place to invest in. You know what I'm going to say here, because Northamptonshire obviously couldn't even afford to hold local elections. The council is so well, it's bankrupt, I think is the word to say. And I read recently that there's a few other councils, local authorities going the same way, not this one, but a few other local authorities looking like they're teetering on the same thing. So just sort of my education, really, did we have any dosh with Northamptonshire? I think I know the answer to that one anyway. If we had dosh with them, what would have happened when a local authority falls into that insolvency that Northamptonshire, I think, is in? Would we have lost it? And is it really fair to say that they're low-risk investments when we're seeing all these reports that there's a whole bunch of local authorities in trouble?
No, we didn't have it any money with Northamptonshire. We would have put it all back.
How?
In terms of Northamptonshire have not been able to set a balanced budget, but they have still been paying all the money they need to pay to people in terms of they have cash. They have, their cash flow is still there. They have cash to be able to fund things. They are stopping spending on certain things and reviewing what they spend their money on, but they are meeting all their debt requirements, and we would have got any money back if we invested with them. That's why I say it's sort of lower risk in that regard, is that whilst on one level Northamptonshire have failed, they haven't fundamentally failed in terms of they have not failed to pay back people who have lent them money.
Right.
Okay, just a quick one, only because I haven't seen the whole report. 30.8 million is what we've got invested. I'm assuming that we have, when we're talking about the reserved capital pots, where's that held? Is that separate to this? So is this just investments, or is this the money that all of these earmarked capital expenditure pots are coming out of?
So minor clarification, 32.4 million as at the end of 2019, 32.8 is at the end of 2018.
Oh, sorry, yes.
Just to get records straight, not because I'm picking on you, sorry. The 32.4 million is the accumulation of all the cash we have, which is made up of all those things I spoke about. It's the accumulation of all that. That's the money we have. It goes up and down. We have cash flow forecasts to make sure we invest so that we've always got cash when we need it to pay things like salaries, the bills, etc.
Okay, so I'm trying to summarise some of those recommendations, and it's great that Ian's here, so you can hear all this. But I think that what we're saying is we'd like to review the risk profile of the diversity of the investments. Mm-hmm. Yeah?
Yeah.
Is that something that's really difficult to do, or is that something that's fairly simple to at least provide the detail for that, Ian?
We can certainly, we certainly get information from our Treasury advisors, which will give you things like credit ratings and historic risk of default measures in relation to our investments. They'll give you an indication of risk profile. It will be very techy, warn you up front, but we can do something on that to sort of try and take that and present it as simply as we can for the committee to sort of get a view.
Yep.
About the risk of our investments.
It would like to see the detail of that. And the other thing was to review the safety of local authority investments in light of recent issues with local authorities.
I don't know what I can do on that. There's no. While some local authorities are credit rated, that is only because they're looking to borrow externally in the same way the government does, and it certainly applies to a few local authorities. So I don't think there's anything I can do in that regard apart from the answer I've given you already in relation to my comments on the security of local authority investments.
And we've got the executive member here who's listening to all of this intently. Okay.
Sorry, just a quick question. Under the pie chart that says where the investments are placed, it says that the average daily balance of investments was 40.3 million, with balances varying between 31.2 and 52.1, which seems quite a lot of variance to me. But is this a normal amount of variance, or is this something that's specifically happening at the moment?
That is a normal amount of variance. That will reflect that on some days we'll get council tax and business rates and housing benefit monies coming in on some days, and it'll go out, will be a day or two later, or that kind of thing. So it will fluctuate up and down. So yes, we expect
quite a degree of fluctuation across the year. And actually, generally, the year-end position is pretty much near the bottom or towards the bottom of those variances, because at that point all the money's gone out and we need to provide this funding to other bodies.
Thank you.
Sorry, I have one, which is a very, very quick question, which is a technicality. Do we have somewhere, and I must admit I haven't read every word on the report, somewhere that states how quickly we can liquefy the investments to actually turn them back into cash?
That's mainly covered by the chart on page 125, which shows the maturity profile of our investments. That's the, I suppose, the worst case. That's when they become due to be repaid back to us. It may be possible to get the money back sooner than that if needed, but that's kind of the worst case. But we do do cash flow forecasting to make sure that we, you know, invest for a period that's safe. You know, it's not we're going to leave money back. We don't even push to the limit. We're kind of quite safe within the limit to have all the money.
Thank you. All satisfied? Yes. Okay. Thank you.
Just say on the request around the kind of the risk stuff, that could come straight back to this committee. That would be within your remit to get a report on that on part of the next Treasury monitoring report. Rather than need to be referred to Cabinet.
Great, thank you. Brilliant. Right, so the only thing left to do is to talk about future meetings, and we've got a statutory kind of forward plan that we have to do, and so we'll be following that. But what we've spoken about already is that actually a lot of our timetable for the future meetings is going to be determined by the bit of paper that you're about to fill in, that you are going to do for me. So I think it's important to kind of think about what it is that we want to learn about, and then the questions will come out of that, and then we can maybe bring things in that we want to, and we have a packed statutory agenda on the way. So I don't think there's value in kind of going through now before we really know what we're doing. What those future meetings might look like. But obviously you've got the dates there, please make sure that they're in your diary. And before we end, just to reiterate one more time, that statement of accounts, I'm saying that right, I'm not looking at the right bit of paper, are on the website, and we've got to approve those at our next meeting, so please, please look through them and know them and get all of your thoughts and questions and ideas ready, and go to Ian early. Yeah? And that's it. I don't know how you formally end these. That's a wrap. Close the meeting.
You've got to drop the mic.
That's all right. Yeah.
Done. We'll turn it off now.
Thank you, Ian. Sorry.
Can I steal your pen?
That one, that's a tablet pen.
That's not going to work.
I'll give you a pen.
So it's like 2 months in a row and then a meeting off, a month off.